Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Lord of Shadows by Tanya Ann Crosby, narrated by Marion Hussey. A most strange creature will come from the sea marsh of Rhiannath, as a punishment of iniquity on Malgwyn Gwyneth, his hair, his teeth, and his eyes being as gold, and this will bring destruction upon Malgwyn Gwyneth. Taliesin. Prologue. Llanros, Wales, 547 AD. The tribes were all at war, brother scheming against brother. The Dragon Lord of Anglesey sat beside his queen, watching a party of dancers as he brooded over the state of his realm. So, it seemed, men no longer needed whips nor chains to sway the masses. All they needed was a bit of gold and a lot of empty promises. The Romans might be long gone, but having left behind their jewelled yokes to be donned by the people of Wales, the weight of their harnesses now grew heavy. For love of those winking jewels, the free all remained oppressed, patting their sated bellies as they toasted from sour casks of vin. Now, the worst had come to pass. But all was not lost. The spirit of the world was alive and well. It was here, in this hall, in every turn of the dancers' lithe bodies, and if anything hardened his cock, it was this. Against the taming of a nation, there was a certain beauty to be found in the old dance. Amidst their graceful motions lay passion and truth, a raw honesty that fired his spirit and stirred the blood. In every revolution the dancers made, he spied the goddess face of the moon and heard the voices of the fey folk singing bard songs to the wind. It stirred a song in his own blood that made him long to strip to his boots and howl at the moon. Alas, these were times for the changelings, those who would convert, or those who would create. But sadly, not for the ones who would cleave to the old ways. Still, he resolved to enjoy it while he could. The Gwython, or Wise One, clad in her fine white robe to symbolize purity and light, twirled at the center of his hall, whilst 12 young disciples danced about her in a circle. One dancer stood out amidst the rest, Sanan, his nephew's young bride. With her soft pink lips and her darkly burnished hair, the girl was striking, but, like her betrothed, there was a certain falseness about her that made Malgwyn feel she could be anyone's for the taking, even his, if he so desired. It was that come-hither look in her jade eyes, a sultry glance that roused him even against his will. She dipped, then spun, raising her hands in thanksgiving to the Mother Goddess, only with a backward glance to the throne, smiling a smile intended only for him. "You like her?" Malgwyn slid his wife a careful glance.
"Sanan?"
Nesta nodded, and he swept away the notion, no longer willing to sow his seed indiscriminately. Together they had created a beauteous daughter, and he still had one son by a previous marriage.
"She's too young," he said.
And, besides, there was too much strife in his kingdom to steal his nephew's bride and then lie abed like a sated boar. The last thing he needed was to become a fat, happy emperor like those he despised. "Mal," she said gravely, "I have not conceived—"
"It matters not," he said firmly. "I am well pleased with the daughter you gave me and my son. What more could any man ask for in life?"
"Only think on it," she argued. "What if something should happen to you? Anyone—"
"She is too young,"
Mal persisted, and though his tone brooked no argument, his wife was not so easily silenced. Her temperament, like her fey kind, was wild as the wind. "Malgwyn, please, you know that Igraine cannot inherit these lands, nor I—"
"Nay,"
he snapped, and still she persisted. "It must be someone. So much as I loathe the thought of sharing you, my sweet husband, you must consider a new bride. Sanan comes from a good line."
"She is promised," he told her,
and Nesta laughed without mirth. "To your nephew? What has the fool ever done save to pit himself against you?" Silence,
because it was true. And yet, Maelgwyn hadn't any stones to throw because he too, in the name of these lands, had slain his uncle. For Wales. She's as good as any, and—
Nay,
he said. And this time she gave him respite, although he knew she would resume her campaign in good time. She was on a mission, and he frowned, because he feared she could be right. The spirit of unrest was growing. The Roman prelates were wagging their silvered tongues. Little by little, the old ways were being abandoned. Nesta herself was the last of a dying breed. Those feyfolk who'd once inhabited the hills overlooking the drowned city. Cauldron-born, she was descended of the acolytes, and he trusted her without fail. She was a gem among women, and though he didn't love her as he longed to love a woman, he still wasn't in the mood to collect more wives. As it was, he had a nest of vipers. Some of them were here tonight. Unfortunately, it was a king's duty to entertain foes. From the dais, he studied the hall's newest guests, Uther, that golden child of the Empire, and his equally golden mage, who, indeed, was quite golden. Everything about the man shone, from his pearlescent skin to his fine gilt hair. Goddess blessed, so 'twas said, and it must be true. The mage was as fair as any druid Mal had ever beheld, and there was, indeed, an aura about him that put Mal in mind to the gods. Both men sauntered into his hall with an arrogance born of privilege and, rather than take up a plate and find themselves a proper seat at one of the lower trestle tables, the pair approached his dais, and Uther, the sodomizing bastard, unsheathed a blade from his scabbard as he came. Beside him, Nesta gasped, leaping up from her seat and sheltering herself at his back as three of Malgwyn's guards rushed forward to impede Uther's approach. Undeterred by the guards, the warlord grinned, slippery as an eel, as he tossed up a hand as though his men were Uther's to command.
Uther,
said Mal in greeting, and he too waved to his guards, urging them to fall back as his nemesis approached. The mage remained by his side as he bowed before Maelgwyn and said,
My friend.
Friend? May the gods rip out his tongue and cast it to the wolves. Uther was no man's friend. He was, as they claimed, a wolf in sheep's clothing. The cords in Malgwyn's neck tightened, though he smiled and said graciously,
Welcome. Our king, on this holiest of nights we come bearing felicitations from the Senate, said Uther, and a gift.
And then, with a flourish, he presented a strange sword, laying it gingerly atop Uther's palms so that the inscription could be read on the shining blade. Maelgwyn blinked with sudden lust. It was only once the revelry resumed that he realized the breath of the world had come to a pause, waiting to see how these foes would meet. As the musicians began to play again and the dancers' feet kicked up more dust, his favored guests brought bits of nuts and fruit to their lips. Maelgwyn leaned closer to inspect the blade. Intricately crafted serpents lay entwined about an elegantly fashioned hilt. Fascinating. On the blade itself, glowing faintly blue in the most ancient of languages, lay inscribed, Take me, but turn the blade, and we will see. But the runes were faint, indeed so faint that the inspired words might have been a chimera.
Incredible.
There was still another word etched betwixt the serpents, and this one could be read more easily. Kalad Fuk, it said. Cut steel. Excellent craftsmanship, and no doubt a bribe, but Maelgwyn was nevertheless bewitched.
Remarkable, he said.
Indeed,
said Uther with a knowing smile, and he flicked a short glance at the mage by his side. No longer quite so concerned over Uther or his mage, Maelgwyn longed to caress the blade.
Who forged this work of art?
It was Taliesin who replied.
It was crafted by the Dynion Mwyn, your grace, he said with a respectful bow.
The fair men.
It was forged from blooms of steel mined from those ancient hills before Avalon's doom.
Maelgwyn blinked,
his heart suddenly thumping with lust unlike any that might be inspired by a woman. The blade was, indeed, a fine, fine work of art, expertly crafted and glowing like a piece of the moon. Every carving on the hilt seemed to shiver and come alive under the play of light and shadow. The serpents themselves appeared to writhe before his eyes.
Astounding.
Shining like tourmalines, Malgwyn's eyes fixed drunkenly on the sword, wanting it with a fervor not only born of greed. It was as though its essence called to him, beguiled him.
"'Tis a gift," repeated Uther, with a smile in his voice.
"For you, we are asked to sue for peace,"
Taliesin added.
"It bears a druid blessing. He who wields the sword will not bleed, and he who possesses it will e'er reign as Dragon Lord of Wales."
Behind him, Nesta hissed like a cat.
"Old man, begone with your gift and your forked tongue!"
She stayed Mal's hand as he reached for the glittering prize, whispering for his ears alone.
"The gifts of your enemies are not gifts, my love. Have you learned naught from our past? Better to send them away."
"Nay,"
said Malgwyn, silencing her with a lift of his hand.
"I shall not forswear a victory gift."
And then, ignoring his wife's counsel, he reached for the sword, utterly enchanted by its essence and form. Try though he might, he could see no reason to turn his head from such a beautiful concession, and it was clearly a concession delivered by the hands of a well-respected druid and a prelate of the Empire. It was the mage who placed the gleaming sword in Malgwyn's hands, lifting it carefully from his master's palm and placing it into Mal's hands with the care and love of a father handing over a first-born child.
"He who wields the sword will not bleed, and he who possesses it will e'er reign as Dragon Lord of Wales."
Desire coursed through Malgwyn's veins with such vigour that he shivered. He accepted the gift and, for a moment, simply tested its weight. Fine, fine cold steel, precisely calibrated by the hand of a master. It was his now, and he could already envision himself wielding it, unsheathing it from his scabbard. The hiss of metal was like a song to his ears. It was only belatedly that he realized the mage still had possession of the blade, and when Mal tried to turn it to inspect it a little better, the druid turned it and slid it back, nicking Malgwyn's flesh, drawing his blood.
"It's only a scratch,"
he said to his wife when she gasped. In truth, Malgwyn was too entranced to care. Enjoying the feel of the sword in his hand, he sent the druid and his master away without so much as a rebuke, and then sat back in his throne, admiring the fine-cut steel.
"He who wields the sword will not bleed, and he who possesses it will e'er reign as Dragon Lord of Wales."
And yet, he did bleed. Studying his prize, he was hardly aware that Nesta abandoned his side or that the dancers continued long into the night, performing without his regard. Wine flowed generously, laughter rang loudly, abundantly, and all the while Uther kept his grin. Unfortunately, Malgwyn was well into his cups before he realized that something was dreadfully wrong. Sweat formed upon his brow, then trickled down his burnsides. His vision swam like a drunken otter, and still, for so long, he blamed it on the wine. Only once he took the sword and draped his hand over the arm of his chair, then dropped the sword with a clang, did he realize. Nesta was right. The gift of an enemy was no gift at all. The sword was cursed. That was his last conscious thought, as the room swam, then faded to black. He awoke in his bed many, many bells later, shivering to his bones. His wife was kneeling by his side, and the chamber was filled with all her ladies, weeping and praying.
"Mal," she whispered softly, her throat thick with spent tears.
"Shh,"
he said, because he already knew what it was she would say, and he didn't have the heart to hear of betrayal on his deathbed.
"How long?"
he rasped. She choked past a sob.
"3 days. 3 days and 3 nights.
That was not what he wished to hear.
How long?
There was so much to be done. And what of his son?
Nesta did not immediately reply. Malgwyn closed his eyes.
Mal,
she whispered, and Malgwyn tried hard to reopen his heavy lids.
My love,
she begged, and this time she shook him very gently till his eyes again opened. But his vision remained hazed, so the figure standing before him morphed into caterwauling banshees, summoning him from his bed to the darkness beyond.
Mal,
she said again, and the single word was so full of agony that it twisted his heart.
Uther,
he asked weakly. Nesta's lips quivered with grief.
He and the mage have withdrawn from our halls till the day breaks on the morrow. His armies remain camped beyond our walls.
My son.
Nesta shook her head with grief, and Malgwyn felt a sob well from his breast to his sore throat. Enion ap Malgwyn was his only true heir if his son was dead. If Uther lay waiting.
You are dying, she confessed between tears, and yet you do not have to.
Nesta, sweet Nesta, was a child of the goddess, cauldron born and cauldron raised. Her knowledge was the knowledge of the ancients. He trusted her without fail.
My love, you must agree to allow it.
Dearest,
Malgwyn said with regret, and he tried to lift a finger to her cheek, falling short of her face. It fell limp beside him on the bed. Indeed, he could feel his life slipping away, like sands in a glass.
Mal,
she cried,
only speak the word and I shall gift you my life. True love's tears might save you.
Oh, yes. They would spend eternity together, he and his beauteous wife, whose glorious bosom was the pillow of his choice. He could learn to love her properly and give Nesta her heart's desire, a prince of her womb.
You and I, he said, forever and ever and ever.
To bloody hell with thrones and crowns. So long as he had her love, he would be happy evermore.
Yea,
he said weakly.
Yea.
His wife rose at once, her tall, lithe body towering over him, her shining gold mane surrounding her like a halo. She spilled her tears into the palm of her hand, and then he heard her words, and recognized the gleam and slash of her ceremonial blade. But even as she worked, he fell in and out of shadow, somewhere at the back of his mind, understanding the rite she was speaking.
Here, with my blade, I take your former life. Here, with my art, I still your beating heart. Eternal thy flame, Lord of Shadows thy name.
And then she knelt once more by his side and said her final goodbye.
Rest in shadow, my beloved, till you are once more summoned to the light.
Invoked, perhaps, by the sultry nature of her words, shadow and light danced before his eyes like fornicating lovers. Shadow and light converged again and again until, with a violent clap of thunder, a rush of wind rose from the casket of his body, and for the sweetest interminable moment, he and his wife were caught between worlds, their souls united as one, until the torrent died like a winterborn in summer, devoid of life, but not quite dead. At the end of her ritual, Nesta's body lay lifeless on their chamber floor. Malgwyn could see it as though in a dream. Her maids lifted her up, then laid her beside the empty shell of her husband, his own body. When Uther arrived to claim the banner and crown, he was told the Dragon Lord's queen ended her life with her husband's last breath. No one noted the reliquary in the hand of her maid. She gave Uther the message with a nervous curtsy, before quitting the chamber, rushing away with a heartfelt promise for the Lord of Shadows.
I shall keep you in secret till the one arrives, and some day, my lord, you must avenge my lady's death. A pox on the House of Pendragon.
Chapter 1 Blackwood Castle, July 1153. He should have died. He did die. And still, here he was, flesh and blood, and it was Morwen who'd freed him. For that alone he owed her a debt of gratitude. Pensive and mirthless, the Lord of Blackwood sat behind his escritoire, studying a small reliquary on his desk. So he'd been told, there were three of its kind remaining in the world, one his, one belonging to Mordecai, and the last, he presumed, must be Morwen's. Presumed? Only because she kept it about her neck on a chain, the same way he kept his own. Exquisitely etched, cylindrical in shape, his was about a half inch in diameter and 1¼ inches long, with a strange blue-veined crystal fashioned at one end, the fit so seamless it was impossible to remove. The metal was intricately inscribed with runes that, to his knowledge, could no longer be read. He met a priest once who'd called it a reliquary, although, in truth, it was nothing like those receptacles they used to hold the bones of saints. It looked like one, perhaps, but it wasn't. If he shook it, there was nothing inside, and if he put it to his ear, he heard a hint of wind, like a seashell. Admittedly, he didn't know how it worked, nor did he dare disassemble it. This was all he knew. It alone was the key to his existence, a ridiculous little bauble that Morwen had called a Grisial Hood. In his Welsh tongue it meant, quite literally, magic crystal. Lifting the pendant from his desk, he turned it slowly, examining the strange metal and markings, perhaps for the 1,000th time since acquiring it. Puzzling. Only to see it was to imagine it an impossible sepulchre, and yet, what dimensions should one expect to provide for the totality of a human soul? It was everything, and yet, nothing. Kyle DeLucy was a creature of shadow, a man with far more to lose by dwelling in light than he did in darkness. He had more secrets than most, and too much to lose, including his life, should they ever come to light. He was confused. He'd come to know Rhiannon Pendragon well, and indeed, his heart wept for Uther's heir. Still, whenever he thought to pity her, he was forced to ask himself, what was 5 years compared to 600? 606, to be precise. 606 years, during which his only conscious thought had been to avenge his beloved's. Now that he had his chance, he dared not rest until the task was done. Then, and only then, could he hope to find peace. Regretfully, the matter had become complicated. Almost daily, he had to remind himself who she was. Lovely though she might be, in her delicate blue veins she bore the sins of her fathers and, in truth, no matter how many years had gone since Uther's betrayal, his sorrow was fresh as the loam over a day-old grave. Thinking of Nesta, his jaw worked angrily. Faded by time, an image arose from the dusty depths of his memory. Her lifeless form, prone on the chamber floor, her sacrifice to save his damnable soul. Was it worth it? Nay, he thought, it was not. And still, for every moment of these past 606 years, he'd been acutely aware of his losses, feeling their pain like limbs plucked from his body. He was the Pendragon, not Uther. And what had the Judas gone and done? He'd settled himself on Kyle's throne, then eaten the meal from his larders. The image sent a torrent of hatred rushing through his blood, for his true name was not Kyle DeLucy. He was Malgwyn ap Caldwashan, High King of Gwynedd, Dragon Lord of Anglesey. He was not the cousin of some paltry English lord, but the first-born son of Cadwashan Clawhir, great-grandson to Cunedda, who, by the order of Governor Maximus, led the Votadini against the Pects, and, for his part in the campaign, his forebear had been awarded the entirety of Gwynedd, the jewel of Wales, so 'twas written by a contemporary of Malgwyn's time. And the true Dragon Lord,
felled by a creature with golden eyes and hair who'd cursed him with a yellow death. He who'd fought and won the dragon throne, only to lose it all. Over what? Lust for a sword? Perhaps she was not the sole heir to Blackwood. Still, she bore the blood of his nemesis in her veins. That alone should keep him from coddling her. That alone should force him to remember.
Remember? Fool, she's not simply some hapless maid whose mother is cruel.
Unlike her sisters, she was not the progeny of a king. Hers was a distinctly immaculate conception, and her father was a reincarnation of the man by whose hand his life was taken, that druid who'd once called himself Merlin to Britain. God's blood, it galled him that she looked like him, all save for that wild copper hair. She bore those same chiseled cheeks, the same fair skin, the same shape of her brows, perpetually arched, as though she alone were privy to the mystery of creation. And God's blood, her eyes, blue and stormy as a winter sky, while Taliesin's had been deepest amber, imbued with a cunning that few could forswear. Not that she wasn't cunning, mind you. She was certainly wily enough to sense every chink in Kyle's armour, and therefore, why should he care whether her hands were weighted with the burden of manacles? Why should he care what became of her? At least she still had lungs to breathe and hands to carry a child of her womb. To the contrary, Nestor's arms were empty in death, and he himself might never see an heir to his legacy, such as it was, a decrepit old castle in the Black Mountains, not at all the kingdom he'd been promised. Certes, not his beloved Anglesey. And what now? He would risk even this for a beauteous witch?
Rhiannon, he said aloud,
testing the weight and feel of her name on his tongue.
Rhiannon.
He couldn't help but remember the way she'd faced him the day he'd met her, straight from her prison tumbril, with her hair dishevelled and her dirt-stained cheeks, her shoulders back and high, like a witch queen in her own right. Even then, she'd had a fire in her eyes that matched the flame of her hair. But now, that blaze was diminishing day by day, and there was a joyless turn to her lips. Still, he owed her mother, he owed for his life, and if he did not keep his promises, Morwen would collect her due. She was a necessary evil, a means for revenge. And aye, she might use him as well, as she used everyone, but he would gladly allow it because, in the end, his goal was her goal, a reckoning for the Pendragon's heirs.
Ah, Nestor,
he said with a heartfelt sigh, and then he attempted, with some difficulty, to summon her golden visage. All that materialized was a flame-haired beauty, whose words cut like diamonds and whose eyes, like a mirror, reflected the same sense of fury as his own.
Rhiannon.
Very, very gingerly, he set down the reliquary, considering the irony that he would now aid and abet the very institution whose gold once sought his ruin. Indeed, with Malgrin ap Cadwashan's death arrived a new day for the Empire. Uther himself became the new Dragon Lord, whose son later ascended to his throne. And where was Malgrin's heir? Dead and buried mere days after his... Startled from his reverie by the blast of a horn, he peered back at the door, suddenly discomposed. This time it would not be her messenger. It would be the Witch Queen herself. 2 months ago, she'd given him an ultimatum. Wed Rhiannon, or wed her. No matter what he chose, the consequences were considerable. Force Rhiannon, and he would lose her evermore. Marry her mother, and he'd risk his own goals. Defy the Witch Queen, and he would lose more than his life. And, he suspected, deep in his heart, she wouldn't be satisfied until her daughter was dead. Knowing this, something other than common sense spurred Kyle from his seat. No doubt Rhiannon had heard the horn blast as well.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?